You're tuned in to the Hearing Matters podcast with Blaise Delfino and Dr. Douglas Beck, the show that discusses hearing technology, best practices, and a global epidemic, hearing loss. Before we kick this episode off, a special thank you to our partners. Cycle, built for the entire hearing care practice. Redux, faster, drier, smarter, verified. Otoset, the modern ear cleaning device. Fader Plugs, the world's first custom adjustable earplug. This episode is going to be hosted by none other than Dr. Douglas Beck himself. Get ready for expert insights and invaluable discussions coming your way.
This is Dr. Douglas Beck, and you are listening to the Hearing Matters podcast. Today's guest is Dr. Julia Sorrent, and Dr. Sorrent is with the University of Melbourne, Department of Audiology and Speech Pathology. Julia, welcome. Glad to have you here today.
Thanks for having me, Doug.
My pleasure. And what I'd like to do, we'll start with the general emerging relationship foundation of cognition and audition, and then we'll go more particularly into the ENHANCE study, which was just published in January of 24. So, Julia, is it fair to say that for people with untreated hearing loss who are at higher risk for cognitive decline, that might be people who are older, people with greater hearing loss, people who are from lower socioeconomic groups, people with comorbidities, those people with untreated hearing loss are at higher risk to exacerbate cognitive decline? Is that a fair place to start?
I think that's a reasonable place to start, Doug, and I think that there is certainly a growing body of evidence to suggest that the risk is higher, because what seems to actually happen is that the rate of cognitive decline is accelerated in these people related to their degree of hearing loss. So it seems to be suggested in the literature that people with greater hearing loss decline more quickly.
So, Julia, the numbers that I'm most familiar with come out of the USA, and some of the numbers that I'm going to speak about come from our literature, and please correct me, because I want to also, of course, discuss Australia and pull your research in. The rate of mild cognitive impairment that the JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association, has used in the last year, as they say, up to 22% of Americans by the time they are age 65 or older have mild cognitive impairment. So that would be one out of five. And then for people, when we're speaking specifically about Alzheimer's, which is one of 200 types of dementia, but Alzheimer's is 65% of all dementias. And people with Alzheimer's, by the time you're age 85 in the U.S., your chance of having Alzheimer's is about one out of three. I think those are the American statistics that I've been reading and quoting, but I'd like your insight. Are those numbers sort of kind of correct or way off?
Yeah, sure. No, I don't think they're way off at all. There are different dementia prevalences in different countries around the world, and I think part of that is due to the healthcare system, the access to healthcare and the access to control of systemic disease that people have. In Australia, the dementia prevalence is quite a lot lower than it is in the US, but I would agree that in general, about a third of people over the age of 80, that statistic is correct.
Okay. Just to fill in for people who aren't as familiar as you are, when we say Alzheimer's and dementia, Alzheimer's is one of, as I said, 200 types of dementia, but most of those dementias, two-thirds of them are Alzheimer's. And then you have things like Lewy body disorders, you have vascular dementia, frontotemporal dementia, you have Parkinson's with dementia. That's probably the vast majority. That probably covers 98% of all people with dementia would be those four or five categories. What about people who have Alzheimer's? Are you familiar with the discussions on tau proteins and amyloid and the prevalence of that in the Alzheimer's population?
I have some familiarity with that. And in fact, I wrote a paper a couple of years ago looking at the relationship between amyloid in the brain and hearing loss to see what was going on there.
What did you find?
We found no relationship.
Yeah.
And that might have been because we only had about 600 or so people in the sample. It might have been simply because, so we could see the relationship until we controlled for age. Once we controlled for age, obviously, because, you know, with age, amyloid increases. With age, risk for dementia increases. So once we took that out of the equation, We didn't see a relationship. There were only about three papers at that time. Another couple have come out. So the jury's still out on what's going on there.
And I think it's kind of fascinating now because we do have some drugs that are very, very good at reducing and slowing amyloid, but that hasn't really had a substantial effect on Alzheimer's disease. In other words...
No, it hasn't.
Yeah, well, and I think that to a large degree, you know, Alzheimer's takes 20 or 30 years to develop from the time you first get microcellular changes. And I think amyloid builds up over time as well, perhaps as a result of that. But I don't think that necessarily taking the amyloid out of the picture changes the course of Alzheimer's, because I wonder if amyloid is the result of that process and not the cause of that process.
I think that's something that people are coming to terms with just recently. There are some papers in the literature talking about the fact that there is a synergistic relationship between amyloid and tau protein
accumulation. Right.
And that without the tau, people can live with the amyloid load and not necessarily develop cognitive impairment. But, you know, it's a really fascinating and tricky area to work in. Dementia, in many ways, to me, is like cancer. It's not one disease, it's many. And it has multiple causes and multiple risk factors, and these interact with each other. So I don't believe it's, and I don't believe the literature suggests, it's only about amyloid. It's about all sorts of things. And the process of aging, the reason that the risk for dementia and cognitive decline increases with age is we have all these other things going on in our bodies. We have so the term inflammaging is often used about older adults. So we have increasing levels of inflammation, and inflammation drives cardiovascular disease and metabolic disease and all these other things that are really significant risk factors for dementia. We also have things like the breakdown of the blood-brain barrier that allows things to go into the brain that can cause changes that may predispose or help this process along. So it's a really complicated and fascinating thing to study. And we still don't really have very many answers about what is causal. It's likely to be, as with cancer, a whole range of factors and a whole range of processes. And that's illustrated particularly where in the studies where people have done autopsies on the brains of people.
Sure, absolutely.
And you see people with massive amyloid load who were completely cognitively, functionally normal.
Absolutely.
It is fascinating. And so that illustrates on its own. It is not just one thing.
Right.
It is a whole range of things.
This is a point that I think is so important that you can have a lot of amyloid and tau proteins and still have relatively normal functioning, normal physiology, even though your brain is undergoing some substantial changes. And this came out, the first time I read about it was because I'm pretty old, but it was back in the 80s and 90s, the Nunn study. Are you familiar with that one?
Oh, remind me.
So it was it was about cognitive reserve. And the idea, this fellow, I can't remember where, I want to say Massachusetts, I may have that wrong. He was studying a bunch of nuns who were in their 80s and 90s. And what he found is that because the nuns, when they had died, they had given permission to do autopsies and to look at their brains. And what he found is that the nuns who were in their 80s and 90s had developed all sorts of Alzheimer's-like tissues, right? Their brain was decaying or changing, you know, in a way consistent with what you might expect from Alzheimer's, but they showed no outward signs and symptoms. And if I get this right, and I hope I do, he said that because the nuns work every day, they work in groups every day, they socialize, they teach, they read in groups, they're doing constructive things, they're doing projects, they're working with children, they're working with other adults. And you see that in the blue zones as well, right? The people in Okinawa who live to be 90 and 100, they're very, very involved in their community. And so his theory is that the more active you are, the more you are learning, the more you are maintaining and growing brain cells, you know, you may have these other problems, but your brain is able to work around them because you're still exercising neural plasticity. And so that's the idea of cognitive reserve, is that the more you learn, the better educated you are across whatever it is, the healthier it is for your brain over the long term.
Exactly. And that explains why you can have two people with the same amount of amyloid in their brain. One has full-on dementia and the other one is completely normally functioning. So, the issue of cognitive reserve is really important for everybody. Most people are really frightened of the risk of developing dementia themselves and pretty much equally frightened of having to care for someone they love with that disease.
In fact, I think that's the number one fear. It's not cancer. It's not cardiovascular disease. It's dementia.
Yeah. Yes. And so the fact that we have cognitive reserve is really powerful and really positive thing to be aware of because we have control. We have quite a lot of control about how we live our lives. We can be aware of the potentially modifiable risk factors for this disease.
Sure.
And we can work on improving our own situation with relation to those. So we can exercise. We can be socially connected. We can educate ourselves. We can do puzzles. We can do all sorts of things that are known to build cognitive reserve. And we're not just sitting waiting to see what happens to us. We actually have control over a lot of what happens to us.
I
control over how it manages.
That's so refreshing to hear. I think that's brilliant. I totally agree with you. And I think that it's so important. And I think this is a point you made in your paper, that hearing care professionals, whether they be otolaryngologists, whether they be audiologists, hearing aid dispensers, they have to know and recognize warning signs and symptoms of cognitive impairment, because if we catch it early and we pay attention to the 12 modifiable risk factors, according to the Lancet 2020, Dr. Gil Livingston and his colleagues, if we do that, we may reduce the opportunity for dementia by perhaps 40%. And there's no guarantees. You could do everything right and still have dementia. There's certainly some people who that happens. But I think what the Lancet 2020 and the previous version of the Lancet on the same topic of dementia said is that if you attend to these potentially modifiable risk factors, that you may change the trajectory and reduce it, your opportunity for dementia by potentially some 40%.
Yes, I think the potentially modifiable risk factors taken together contribute to about 40% of a risk. So that's an enormously powerful statistic.
Yeah, it sure is. Okay. Well, with that as background, what I'd like to do, let me see if I had some notes here from your early paper. And, you know, one of the things that comes up a lot, people say, well, what is it about hearing and listening that would impact your brain? And in one of the papers I wrote a few years ago, we had four hypotheses on that. And I noticed, I know I'm catching you a little bit off guard, but what you and your colleagues said, so this is the paper that was September 2023 in the International Journal of Audiology. We talk about, well, why would hearing or listening have anything to do with cognition and stuff like that? And you mentioned a few different potential hypotheses. The first one, and I'll give you the hypotheses and perhaps you can just give us a sentence or two on it. One was the common cause or the common neuropathic pathology for hearing loss and dementia.
Yeah, so that's the theory that there is the same neuropathic pathology driving both the onset of hearing loss and the development of hearing loss, and also that of dementia, and that this affects the cochlear and the ascending auditory pathway causing hearing loss and the cortex causing dementia.
That's a neuronal phenomena, if that is indeed the one that we're talking about, right? But then there's also a vascular version of that, where we talk about the labyrinthine artery, which is one of the smallest arteries in the body, which feeds the inner ear. And we talk about if you have atherosclerosis, you have hardening of the arteries, you have a lot of goo in your arteries, maybe cholesterol, triglycerides, whatever. And as time goes on, so the blood flow to the cochlea may be reduced. And also the blood flow through the middle cerebral artery and the posterior arteries, anterior arteries is also reduced by the same atherosclerosis or, you know, deposits. So you have that common cause theory that prevails, I think, in neuronal disease, which is what you started with, and I think also in vascular disease, if the labyrinthine artery is not well supplied with blood and nutrients within the blood and oxygen and red blood cells and iron and everything we need with glucose and you know, then the same phenomena could occur throughout the brain as well.
Yes. And so those are theories that are not reversible, not addressable by hearing intervention.
Right.
And this is where we go back to this, my sense that dementia is like cancer. It has multiple risk factors.
I'm so glad you said that. Because, you know, Aage Möller wrote about this with tinnitus. He said, tinnitus is not one thing. Tinnitus is many things. And in each person, it could be different.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, in addition to those hypotheses, there are other hypotheses that could be potentially modifiable. Do you want to start off on that or would you like me to?
So the one I think you're talking about is the information degradation theory.
Let's take a quick break. Running a private practice is challenging, and it's especially difficult if you're using a management software system that's out of date or doesn't really fit your needs. As a former private practice owner, I personally found Cycle to be such an incredible tool that is easy to use and is really in the best interest of my patients. Cycle provides you with industry-specific workflows and features for a smooth-running front office. And if you've been listening to the Hearing Matters podcast, you will know that I believe that the front office staff is really the most important position in a hearing care clinic. Learn more at cycle.com. That's cycle.com. Enjoy the rest of the episode.
Yes, so if you have a degraded auditory signal, there is greater cognitive effort required by the brain to process that signal. And often the theory is that other cognitive resources are recruited from other potential tasks, such as memory and executive function, to speech perception, for example. And that means that those other functions are not performed so well because they've essentially been robbed of resources for those tasks. So that's, yeah, that's, I would call that more the cognitive load theory, I think is the, but yeah, both of those terms have been used.
And the final one you guys mentioned is the altered cortical brain activity due to hearing loss causes irreversible molecular degenerative damage.
That's a newer theory.
Yes.
There's only been one paper on that. I think the other two potential mechanisms are that we haven't directly addressed are decreased auditory stimulation, the use it or lose it.
Sure.
If you don't stimulate an area of the brain, then you can have degeneration, and we see that in shrinkage of the cerebellum and the auditory cortex, and also the other flow on effects. If you have reduced environmental stimulation and your communication ability is lower, that can lead to social participation withdrawal, and which may contribute to loneliness, social isolation, depression, and these things are also risk factors for dementia. So there
absolutely
are flow-on mechanisms from these biological ones.
And most of those came out in the Lancet study, the 2020. They identified depression and social isolation and hearing loss. And of course, these things are they don't act in and of themselves. If you have hearing loss, that can promote social isolation because you can't converse as easily or readily. So perhaps you tend to stay away from other people and stay by yourself. Same with depression. Of course, if you're not able to interact and communicate easily, effortlessly, it's a little bit depressing. It can make you anxious, can make you, you know, socially isolated. And so these things all can work together. I think I did an analysis back in 2020, so 4 years ago, looking at those 12 potentially modifiable risk factors. And I think I had six of the 12 related back to hearing loss, you know, could be secondary impact from hearing loss. Anyway, so that's a great orientation. And if you don't mind, what I'd like to do in our last 15 or 20 minutes is I really want to underscore the January 2024 Frontiers in Aging in Neuroscience, your ENHANCE study, because I think most people in hearing healthcare are familiar a little bit, you know, with the studies that came out of Baltimore, Frank Lennon colleagues, you know, the ACHIEVE study. But I think that the ENHANCE study is just as important to understand. And I know you were one of the primary authors. So if you would outline that, and we'll talk a little bit about what you did and what you found.
Sure. So the ENHANCE and the ACHIEVE studies have actually run in parallel. So unlike the ACHIEVE study, the ENHANCE study is an observational study, non-intervention observational study. And we had two groups of people. We had a control group who were more representative of the normal population. They were derived from an existing study of aging, and it's particularly a study of cognitive aging.
Yes.
And of dementia, called the ABLE study, which is quite a famous study that's been running in Australia since 2006. So we recruited our control group from that study, and that group consisted of only about a bit less than half of the people in that study had hearing loss.
Right.
And on average, that hearing loss was incredibly mild. It was something like 21 dB average hearing loss. And the other people had normal hearing. And so we had that group of people as our control group. They did not have hearing aids or cochlear implants or anything. They had no devices, no intervention. And then we recruited from clinics in Melbourne people who did have hearing loss. On average, that was a mild hearing loss as well, 31 dB average hearing loss. The two groups were around the same age, about 74 years mean age. And we intervened with the hearing aid, the hearing loss group that we recruited from our audiology clinics. And we started off assessing at baseline, and we followed them up at 18 months and 36 months. And we're continuing to follow up both groups of people ongoing, and which is really important. And one of the limitations of a lot of the studies that have been done, trying to tease out the effects of hearing intervention on cognition, is that they don't follow up for long enough. And as you said, the process of developing cognitive decline and dementia is decades long. So why would we expect to see anything, any effect of hearing intervention after 6 months or 12 months? We really wouldn't.
And if
so
I can,
that's why.
I want to frame this. Everything you said is fine, and I'm so glad you did. But I have the numbers from your study, so let me apply those. So you had 160 people who had hearing loss who were treated with hearing aids. And as you said, they were pretty much mild hearing losses. And then there were, I believe, 102 people in the untreated hearing loss and normal. So group two, the control group, some of them had a mild loss, some had absolutely normal thresholds. So we're comparing mild losses that are treated and mild losses that are untreated, right? And you had them at time zero when they entered the study, 18 months and 36 months. And you're looking specifically at the MMSE, the mini mental state exam. And then you used, I forget what the COG state, right, to follow up.
Yep. So we used the mini mental to screen for dementia, for pre-existing dementia, because we didn't want to muddy the waters.
Yep.
Because as you know, particularly if you have something like mild cognitive impairment, about a third of people progress to dementia, a third of people stay stable, and a third of people can actually revert back to normal, and we don't know why. So you need enormous sample sizes.
Absolutely.
To be able to control for all of that variance in outcomes, none of which you can explain and which may or may not be related, likely not related to hearing loss. So we did that. And another strength of the study was that we used the COG state battery.
Yep.
And that is visually presented on a computer. It's computer-based card games, which takes away any language issues. It takes away cultural issues. Most people around the world, the guy who designed that test, Paul Maruff, had the brainwave of this is how we could test cognition internationally and take away the cultural influences and disadvantages for various peoples. Is everybody, he was in Asia, and
yeah.
And he was in a village in the middle of nowhere, and they were playing essentially a card game. And he thought, wow, you know, this can really be useful. And he came home and he devised this test. The most important thing about that test, apart from its sensitivity to small changes over periods of time, is the fact that it is not auditorily administered. So we completely take out the hearing element. And again, that's been a big problem, I think, with a lot of the studies that have been done.
So glad you said that. So this has been something I first wrote about this, I think, in 2009 or 2011 with Carol Flexer. And we were talking about cognitive screenings back then. So that was 100 years ago. Well, actually, about 15 years ago. And this occurred to us as we were writing the paper. that many people who were getting cognitive screenings 15 years ago, they were older folks in their 60s, 70s, 80s. You'd expect they would have hearing loss. So they're getting a oral or a verbal spoken cognitive screening from a psychologist or a social worker or somebody who has no idea what their hearing is like. So they don't know that they're even understanding or hearing the questions. Yet their responses to that are what's saying whether or not they had cognitive issues. So this is very, very important to use a test that, number one, could be universal. That would be great. Number two, does not rely on audition, because we know that many of the signs and symptoms of hearing loss, language delays, language problems, super threshold listening disorders, auditory processing, subclinical hearing loss, many of these problems will interfere and mask and parade just like cognitive problems. And if you're not doing a comprehensive audiometric evaluation to really understand that the patient is able to not just hear, but make sense of. So hear and listen to the questions they're being asked so that they can respond appropriately. If we're not making sure that we've done that, we really don't know what the answers mean. And this is one of the beautiful things with the Cogstate. The other one that is non-auditory is the CogniVue Thrive. And there's probably two or three others. I think there's a new MoCA version that's HI, hearing impaired. I haven't seen that one myself. I read about it when the German version came out probably a year or 2 years ago. I don't know if it's available in English, but it's for older and hearing impaired people, because the vast majority of older people have hearing impairment. By the time you're 65, one out of three people in the US has hearing loss. By the time you're 75, two out of three people in the US have hearing loss. By the time you're 90, it's about 98% of all people in the US have hearing loss. So this is very important what you're saying, that you have to be sure the patient can hear and listen to the stimuli, whatever it is, in order to get a valid answer.
Sure. And another thing I think that's important to think about is that not only do they have to, we have to know that they're understanding the instructions. The other thing that happens when you are struggling with hearing loss to listen to instructions is you have increased cognitive load in doing the task. And that can also impact on your performance on the cognitive assessment.
Sure. But
you are actually doing a harder task than somebody who has normal hearing and is not having trouble understanding what it is they're supposed to be doing. So that's a further reason for not using auditorily administered tests. And so that's a big difference between the ACHIEVE and the ENHANCE study.
But anyway,
ACHIEVE used auditorily administered tests. ENHANCE was purely visual.
Right. And you know, some clinicians, I mean, to this day, 2024, we're in April, will say, oh, I can tell if they have hearing loss. And I have news for you. I've been an audiologist 40 years. You cannot tell if somebody has hearing loss. If you don't do a comprehensive audiometric evaluation, you're guessing. And guessing, there's really no place for that in science. We either do things correctly or we do things less than correctly. And you know, I don't want to say anything negative about the ACHIEVE study because it was brilliant. You know, they from execution to publication, everything about it I liked. But I think you're right. It's a potential pitfall. Another potential pitfall, one that I wrote up almost a year ago, just when it came out, so just under a year ago. You know, there's really not a control group. I mean, this is something that in my mind, maybe there is a control group. I'm not a statistician. But what they did is they gave brilliant counseling to one group and they gave hearing aids to another. And so these two groups changed together. And what they said is that over time, you didn't see any difference in the group that got hearing aids. But there was no control group. You had a control group. You had people who were untreated. What the ACHIEVE study had is two groups who were treated. One who was treated with hearing
differently.
Aids. Right. So if they had changed together, you're not going to see any changes. And then in their other group, in the secondary group that they reported, these are the people who were at much higher risk. Again, they had multiple comorbidities. They had lower socioeconomic. They had less education. They were older. They had more hearing loss. Lots of things going on. And they found that in those people over the 3 years, the people who wore hearing aids got about a 48% lesser cognitive decline. Did I say that correctly?
The rate of cognitive decline decreased by 48%.
Yeah, the rate of cognitive decline decreased. So that was important. And again, I don't mean to criticize that study at all. It was brilliant. I wish I had been a part of it. But there's a couple of flaws, and there's always flaws. Every study I publish has at least one or 75. So I'm not, you know, I don't want anybody to think I'm disrespecting that. I think it's brilliant work. But
no,
your study,
I think it's really important when you consider the evidence. The ACHIEVE study has made a massive contribution
absolutely.
To the body of evidence. It's the first large scale randomized clinical trial, and we've learned a lot, and we're going to continue to learn a lot as they publish more of the data. But as we're considering any evidence, we have to look at the flaws, the strengths, yeah. the weaknesses, and we have to take the results into those into account when we interpret the results, so that we learn from
absolutely.
Them appropriately, and we know where to go from next.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, they've said they're going to keep following these people, and they're going to publish more brilliant work as time goes on. But I think the lesson is that we have to take it in context and say, okay, these are the strengths, these are the weaknesses, which they readily admit. There's nothing shocking in anything that we just said. So, but this does fall under a different situation now with the ENHANCE study, because you had an untreated group that received no treatment whatsoever, and you compared that to the group that was treated with hearing aids. And I believe that your essential core outcome was that hearing aid use may delay cognitive decline. Is that fair? Did I say that right?
Yeah, that's the conclusion we came to, because we didn't actually see any significant cognitive decline in our hearing aid group, whereas we did see decline in the control group. And that was quite surprising to me, firstly, because it was only 3 years, and I still consider that to be a relatively short period of time. Secondly, because there is a process that's going on for all of us that we call cognitive aging.
Sure.
And that process starts in our 20s and involves ongoing cognitive decline at about a rate of approximately 1% per year. So we didn't see what we would expect to see in terms of normal cognitive aging. And then when you consider the fact that these people had hearing loss and you would expect that rate to increase.
Yes.
We didn't see it. And so that I'm very, very excited about that for those reasons.
Yeah, and so the hearing aid may have offered some sort of protection. It certainly didn't reverse cognitive decline, but it may have slowed it down. And you guys looked also not just at hearing and not just at cognition, but I'm looking at your paper, objective speech.
Doug, can I just
yes.
interrupt just for one
Please.
Minute just to clarify? We didn't see, so whereas the ACHIEVE study saw a slowing of the rate of cognitive decline, we saw none.
Oh, that, yes.
So, Thank no you. Cognitive decline, and that's really important. We may see it in the future, and I'm waiting to see what happens, because people can't stay the same for the rest of their lives. But we didn't see, when we compared the two groups, we didn't see overall any cognitive decline in the treated group, whereas we did in the untreated control group.
And that is brilliant. And I that's why when I read this, I started sending you email. I said, we need to talk about this. So you did a little bit more than just looking at cognitive screenings in with the two tools and hearing tests. You did speech and noise tests. You did medical health history, genetic screening, anxiety and depression, health and lifestyle, education. And all of that was taken into the statistical analysis when you said that we did not see cognitive decline in the people
Correct.
Who wore hearing
yep.
aids over that period of time.
Yep.
So,
and the other thing that's really important about this study also is objective data. So we didn't ask people to report whether they had a hearing loss. We audiometrically, objectively assessed it, and we continue to assess it at every assessment point. We also, it's really important in a drug trial, when you give people medication, you need to know that they're swallowing that medication. In the same regard, we use data logging to see how much are people using their hearing aids, under what circumstances are they using the hearing aids, how many hours a day are they using their hearing aids. And we also measured, so is the treatment being complied with in terms of objective use of the hearing aids? And also, are the hearing aids working? Because how are we going to interpret the results if we don't know that we're getting a significant benefit to speech perception, either in quiet or in noise? So that's something, again, that was really important to have objective data on in interpreting these results.
And it was so refreshing to read your study. There are quite a few studies now that have found similar findings where, and I have a brand new paper that's coming out, I want to say June or July. It's sort of an update on cognition, audition, amplification. And it's a screen, a pilot test that some of my colleagues in New Jersey did. And I can't talk about the results because it hasn't been published yet. But we see in the literature quite a few papers now, quite a few peer-reviewed articles that have said, the group that got the treatment of hearing aids, generally speaking, didn't decline or did better than the untreated group. And there's quite a few of those. I'll talk about them in my paper, which is in June or July. And I know that in your work, you've come across those as well. So what is the take-home lesson that you would like the listeners to get from the ENHANCE study? Because I think it was brilliant. I think it's just about the best research study on cognition and audition that I've read to date. And I'm very proud of you for participating in creating this.
Thank you, Doug. This is
absolutely huge. And so in your words, what should the listeners know about audition, cognition, and amplification?
I'd like to actually borrow somebody else's words in the take-home message. And those are the words of Jan Bluestein, Josh Chodosh, and Barbara Weinstein. I think, you know, something that's really easy and simple as a take-home message is hearing better can help you think better.
I love it.
I think, though, it's really important not to just focus on cognitive health because, as you are well aware, having good hearing enables and prevents or at least decreases so many of the comorbidities of hearing loss. And those are impacts on physical health, social connectedness, mental health, function, maintenance of function. And I think that audiologists are in a really prime position to help older adults to maintain their function, their quality of life, and their well-being through to older age. And using hearing aids is, for me, a no-brainer. And it appears now that we may be able to add looking after our cognitive health as a further benefit to hearing aid use. But we mustn't forget all of these other enormous benefits that hearing aid use give us.
Absolutely. I am so so delighted to meet you and to work with you. And Julie, I want to thank you for your time. This has been a wonderful session. I learned so much listening to you, and I'm so happy that you had the time to record with us for the Hearing Matters podcast. And looking forward to working with you again.
Thank you very much, Doug. It was a pleasure.
Thank you, Julie.
Thanks again for tuning into the Hearing Matters podcast today. I'm your host, Blaise Delfino, and on behalf of our entire team, thank you so much for the support. Truly, it means so much to us. Head on over to the Apple Podcast app and share your thoughts. What did you like most about this episode, and what do you like most about our podcast? 5-star reviews are always appreciated. And also, head on over to Instagram, hit that follow button, and let's connect. And as a team, we can continue to help our community hear life's story.